Hello, this is Guardian Daily for Thursday, the 27th of November 2008. I'm Andy Duckworth. On today's podcast, following protests at Bangkok Airport, Thailand's Prime Minister goes on TV to reject calls for him to step down.
The occupation of Government House, which is the equivalent of 10 Downing Street, let's say, or the White House, for 3 months would never have been allowed to take place anywhere, really, whether you're talking an autocratic regime or a democracy. It's quite remarkable.
The Tories accuse Labour of planning a lifetime of tax rises, as the Prime Minister admits he considered taking VAT above 18.5%.
We looked at every option over the last few weeks, including options that were taken up by the last Conservative government. And we rejected the proposal to raise VAT in favour of a proposal to lower VAT.
He's on the board of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee and has been described as a maverick because of his gloomy economic forecasts. We hear from David Blanchflower.
I'm very upset by the fact that I got it right. I mean, in the way I think of it as the winner's curse, this is not something I wanted to get right.
And the Sicilian underworld, literally. A network of tunnels is discovered beneath a housing estate that mafia hitmen used as a firing range.
This facility gave them the opportunity to practice with pistols in an area that was soundproofed and they believed absolutely safe from any kind of scrutiny.
But first, here's Sandy Waugh with today's news and a flick through the papers.
Gunmen ran amok during the night in the Indian city of Mumbai, attacking hotels, hospitals and a railway station. Commandos have laid siege to 2 hotels where the terrorists are still holding hostages. More than 100 people have been killed and around 300 wounded, say police. Among the dead was the head of the local state anti-terrorist squad. Eyewitnesses said the gunmen were searching out people with British and American passports. Mumbai is India's financial capital, and the attacks took place in the financial and tourist heart. A group calling itself the Deccan Mujahideen has claimed it led the attacks. Our correspondent, Randeep Ramesh, is in Mumbai.
Actually, Tim, we're just leaving the Taj Hotel. There are mass commandos in the gardens of the Taj. The Taj itself is one of those symbols of Mumbai, right next to the Gateway of India. You can hear the ambulances just rushing past. What appears to have happened, at least what the reports we've been getting, is about 12 terrorists, that's according to Indian television, are still holed up inside the Taj Hotel with a number of hostages. There are also some reports of negotiations taking place. The whole area has been closed off, and what we're just seeing is army traffic and commandos.
And this is not the only hotel that's still believed to having hostages being held inside it?
No, that's right. The Oberoi Trident Hotel has also got hostages. Now, we went there earlier today. Again, very similar scene. Lots of police, lots of press, lots of commandos. The only difference there is, as we understand it, there has been some communication with people inside saying that I'll kill a hostage if you don't move away from the building. But again...
So give us an idea of the extent of the attack overnight.
Well, there have been about 8 places hit in Mumbai in various forms or another. A popular cafe was shot up, main station, where a great number of people, dozens, died. People just came in wielding guns and sprayed bullets across a busy commuter platform. They're pretty gory pictures. Now, this sort of coordinated guns and grenades type attack is something we usually see in Indian Kashmir. It's not something that's taken to the streets of major cities. Major cities have seen coordinated, synchronized bombing strikes. This is of a different order. It's a different kind of terror tactic. It seems to be one thing that everybody can agree on. It has literally closed down Mumbai. This is a very busy city, one of the biggest cities in the world, and there is no traffic on the streets. You can make it down to the airport, down to the hippest tip of Mumbai in less than half an hour. That's a remarkable in a city that would take normally a couple of hours to do that journey.
Randeep Ramesh in Mumbai. In Thailand, anti-government protesters have blockaded a second local airport, cutting off the capital city of Bangkok. They blockaded the main international airport on Tuesday, calling on the government to resign and for the army to take over. The Prime Minister has refused the calls and the army has said it will not take over. But the army chief has asked for parliament to be dissolved and for there to be new elections. The security forces have not cleared the demonstrations either, and it's left thousands of tourists unable to leave the country. We'll have more on this story later in Guardian Daily. In China, the country's richest man has been arrested on corruption charges. He's the chairman of China's leading electronics shopping chain and is alleged to have been involved in share price fixing. Back in Britain, the government's climate change watchdog says expanding Heathrow Airport would not necessarily endanger the environment. Lord Turner, chairman of the Independent Climate Change Committee, told The Guardian it would be possible for Heathrow to have a third runway. He said it could be done in a way that would not threaten plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions. Football, and Liverpool beat Marseille in the Champions League thanks once again to a headed goal by captain Steven Gerrard. Chelsea, on the other hand, only managed a draw against Bordeaux. In cricket, England have decided to abandon their tour of India after the terrorist attacks in Mumbai. Some of the papers have managed to get the Indian attacks on their front pages. Terrorists run amok in Mumbai, says The Guardian. Massacre in Mumbai, says The Independent. The Times uses the city's old British name, headlining Carnage in Bombay. It also suggests that Al-Qaeda was linked to the attack, while The Guardian talks about possible involvement of another faction, the Banned Students' Islamic Movement of India. The Financial Times, Express and Mirror choose the collapse of Woolworths and the furniture chain MFI. Blunder of Woolies, says The Mirror, while the FT says simply that the banks pull the plug on Woolworths. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
Thailand's Prime Minister has rejected his army chief's call to step down to end the country's political crisis. It's as anti-government protesters have forced the closure of Bangkok's international airport. Somchai Wongsawat says he's aware of calls for him to dissolve parliament, but insists his government was elected and a democracy under constitutional monarchy. Hundreds of stranded tourists have been taken by coach to out-of-town hotels, with holidaymakers speaking of chaos and confusion inside the terminal. John Virgo is from the International Crisis Group, an independent organisation committed to preventing and resolving conflict.
Well, the protesters want, first, the Thai government out of office, and they regard the Thai government as proxies for the Thaksin regime, which was elected by popular mandate on several occasions. You'll recall 2006, a military coup pushed Thaksin aside. Thaksin's party, without Thaksin, regained power with a large popular mandate in December last year. And now the protesters want the current government out.
Do they have the backing of the military? I mean, the military has asked for the dissolution of parliament in a way of achieving the protesters' aims. Do they have that tacit backing of the military?
I think that's still unclear. And the protesters all along have been quite explicitly trying to force the situation to get to a point where there's a military coup, where the military feel obliged to step in. The military have been very reluctant to do it because they made a mess of it last time in 2006, and they know it. They don't want responsibility for the mess that the country's in. But there's no doubt that there are military figures and establishment figures from the palace and elsewhere who are giving at least tacit backing to these demonstrators.
I was going to ask, well, what is the position of the king in this? Because they're obviously, you know, they're monarchists. Do they have the full backing of the king?
That's not clear. The king has said nothing. This has always been the king's way. He's almost, if you like, the solution of last resort in Thai politics. In many cases in the past, he has stepped in when things have been at the point of getting out of hand. But he has to marshal that last judgment role quite carefully, not to step in at the wrong point where he might find himself discredited with one side or the other. So what the king thinks isn't clear. It's very clear, though, that there are people around the king who are giving various degrees of backing to the demonstrators, to the People's Alliance for Democracy. And a lot of people, for example, have seen the Queen's attendance at a funeral for somebody who was killed during a demonstration as an explicit sign of her backing, at least, for the demonstrators.
Now that the army has called for dissolution of parliament, does the Prime Minister have any option than to comply?
It's actually the second time that the army chief has called for the dissolution, and the Prime Minister stood his ground last time. Everyone's playing a game of brinkmanship here. The People's Alliance for Democracy, the PAD, have been occupying Government House since last August with almost no visible effect. I mean, they haven't forced the government out. They haven't achieved their ends. And my sense is that public tolerance for them has been starting to wane. I think this is a last throw of the dice. It's not a sign of strength. It's a sign of weakness that they've had to push it this far.
And who are the PAD? What do they stand for?
Well, they call themselves the People's Alliance for Democracy, but they're anything but Democrats. they're a ragbag coalition. Some people who were former Thaksin allies of the former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra, now disillusioned. Some businessmen who felt they were losing out under the Thaksin regime. And a lot of what you might call sort of conservative establishment types, whether they're ex-military or around the palace or whatever. And essentially, they don't like the fact that Thaksin and Thaksin's parties, Thaksin's populist policies, keep winning elections. And they keep winning elections because Thaksin, for the first time, gave some things to the rural majority in the country. They don't like it. What they're calling for is some sort of new politics, which frankly would not be democracy. They're calling for a partially or largely appointed parliament.
John Virgo from the International Crisis Group speaking to The Guardian's diplomatic editor, Julian Borgia. And for the latest developments in Thailand, go to guardian.co.uk/world. Also on The Guardian's website today, there's an exclusive interview with Adair Turner, the chairman of the government's newly created Committee on Climate Change, guardian.co.uk/environment. The latest developments in the case of a father who raped his two daughters over more than two decades. And David Wilson asks how the welfare state failed to prevent it. That's at guardian.co.uk/news. Some incredible pictures of pirate ships spotted from space. That's at guardian.co.uk/world. And Roger Browning on why consumers can and should hit back at overmighty corporations after Apple had its ad banned for exaggerating the speed of its iPhone. guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. So, a lively day in the House of Commons yesterday. It began with Prime Minister's questions when Tory leader David Cameron asked about those plans to increase VAT.
If the government doesn't have a secret plan to increase VAT, can the Prime Minister tell me why did the Treasury Minister put his signature to it?
We looked at the 1980-83 recession and we found out that when the Conservatives rose VAT from 8 to 15%, hard-working families were hurt. We looked at the 1990s, and when the Conservatives raised VAT from 15 to 17.5%, hard-pressed families were hurt. And when he was advisor to the Treasury, they tried to raise VAT on fuel to 17.5%. So, Mr. Speaker, we looked at all options, as the Chancellor said. We rejected the option of raising VAT. We decided we would lower it, and I hope the Conservative Party will support us.
There was then an emergency Commons debate on this week's pre-budget report. In it, a former Tory Chancellor warned that Britain is probably facing the longest and deepest recession for more than 60 years. Kenneth Clarke hit out at the appalling scale of the fiscal gap exposed in the government's finances. He said they showed £20 billion was not available for the Chancellor's fiscal stimulus. Guardian columnist Michael White is in our Westminster office. Mike, the opposition got their emergency debate. Did they make the most of it?
Well, emergency debates are an old-fashioned thing. Old gentleman like me remembers when, you know, MPs on either side had them all the time. But these traditions have sort of faded away a bit, so I was glad to see it. And quite a fighting occasion it was, too. George Osborne, he's got a lot to prove at the moment. He's had a good week. His party's rallied behind him after his terrible autumn over Mr. Deripaska and that yacht. But they've decided that going for spending cuts as a way of tackling a monetary response, lower interest rates, spending cuts, which sustain each other, a monetary response to the crisis is better than the government's, which is a kind of tax and spending approach, a fiscal response. So Osborne got a great deal of support, and Alistair Darling just took it like he always does and fought back in his own way. Three-hour debate, quite strong stuff all the way through. What came out of it? Well, mainly the two parties sustaining their own positions. But one interesting fact for Guardian readers, Alistair Darling said that the suggestion that the government was going to raise VAT by 1% after cutting it from 17.5% to 15% back to 18.5%, all very complicated, said that wasn't true. Of course, they'd looked at all the options. Governments always do. But the suggestion that his junior minister, Stephen Timms, had signed off on this policy, and it appeared on the website as such. He hadn't done. An official had stuck his name by it, but Mr. Timms had never seen it and had certainly not signed it. Doesn't change anything at all, but it caused a great deal of excitement in the last 24 hours.
So which side came out on top? Have we heard the last of this?
Well, that's always a matter of opinion. Mr. Osborne's side supported him well. They think he's had a good week. Alistair Darling, who's sort of Mr. Calm temperament, seems to fit the crisis we're in, and does his stuff. Vince Cable is always interesting, of course, the Liberal Democrat spokesman, and he said, you know, it's childish for the government to say this crisis was created entirely in America, and childish for the Tories to say it was created entirely by Gordon Brown's excessive borrowing in recent years. There's an element of both, of course there is. Ken Clark, another interesting figure with economic credibility, weighed in several times. He joins debates, the former Chancellor, half a dozen times a year when he's got something to say. He's always good value, and said, and I'm quoting roughly here, I think, that this is going to be the longest and deepest recession for Britain in 60 years. And like a lot of Tories, he said, this crisis is about banks and about credit, and what we've really got to do is get the plumbers in and get my phrase not his and get the credit freeze unblocked. We've got to get those banks working. So that's one point on which both sides agree.
And Mike, it's been announced that President Obama, as he will be by then, has accepted an invitation from Gordon Brown to come to Britain in his first 100 days of office for a meeting of world leaders here in Britain.
Well, there's always a great rush with a new president of the United States, especially such a glamorous and interesting one as President-elect Barack Obama. All the politicians, in quite a childish way, want to be the first one to see him in the White House, shake him by the hand in the Oval Office, all that nonsense. Tony Blair and Mr. Chirac, President Chirac of France, used to get into a tiz over this. And I don't think Gordon Brown is quite so crazy about that sort of thing, but he'd still like to be there. I suspect that Nicolas Sarkozy of France, who's the president of the European Union, so he has two claims, will get to President-elect Obama first, and it's all President Obama as he'll be. But if he's coming to Britain, maybe that's how they'll split the difference. The Frenchman gets to see him first in America, but he comes to Britain first as president, so everybody's happy.
Michael Weiss in Westminster, and there's full analysis at guardian.co.uk/politics. Henrik Ibsen wrote, "The strongest man in the world is he who stands most alone." David Blanchflower knows all too well what he means. The British-born economist, who now lives on the east coast of the US, has spent much of the past year warning of the threat of a looming recession. He's one of the nine members on the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee. They have the power to set interest rates and, by doing so, steer the nation's economy towards monetary stability. Blanchflower consistently argued that unless the Bank of England cut interest rates to stimulate the economy, the country would pay a heavy price. Britain could fall into a deep and prolonged downward spiral. But nobody listened. He's been speaking to The Guardian's Ed Pilkington.
Externally, people said, basically said, you know, people said he's a nutcase, no one listens. I mean, the various ex-members of the MPC said things. Someone said, oh, you know, no one ever listens to him, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Various of them said he's no idea what he's doing, you know, he's kind of bonkers. Well, no, I think they've said that. They basically sort of said he doesn't know what he's talking about. And increasingly, I was of the view that I was right. So I think at the TSC, the Treasury Select Committee, one day, I said I felt the weight of the British people on my shoulders. I felt this was about trying to do the right thing, and I was worried that recession was coming, and I made a speech in April which just said, we need to act now, I'm worried about what's coming, and I'm worried that perhaps, and I took it on myself saying, I think it was I took some responsibility that I hadn't been able to persuade others of the view.
Did you ever have self-doubt?
All the time. Well, I just kept thinking, maybe I'm wrong, what if I'm wrong? And one of the things I always tell my students is very seriously, every time you think about a policy move, always try and think about what's the implications if you're wrong. If the capital markets were struggling, if people couldn't get capital, they couldn't spend things, the fundamentals on the demand side would take over. That's a bit technical for people, but it means that people would stop spending because they couldn't get money. If you can't get money to buy houses, the housing market starts to slow. People aren't buying fridges, they can't buy cars, they're not buying removal stuff. They're not removal firms are going into trouble because people aren't moving anymore. Surveyors are in trouble. And then it starts to carry on because then people aren't spending and it starts to have a cycle, and that's what business cycles are about. So it seemed to me that downward spiral was in train, if you like, by about the spring of this year. And I did a lot of regional visits. I went around and talked to a lot of companies around Britain. And I was hearing that all the time, that things had started to slow from about April, May time. And the surveys were saying it, my regional visits were saying it, the bank's agents were saying it, and I was saying it, but the profession and the commentators weren't really listening.
Was there any attempt to dissuade you, being as public as you were, about your views?
I'm an independent member of the Bank of England, and I took that very seriously, and I decided that I was going to do what I needed to do. I was an independent member, and I was going to say what I wanted to say. I'm very upset by the fact that I got it right. I mean, in the way I think of it as the winner's curse, this is not something I wanted to get right. This is really something I didn't want to be true. And when I was warning against this, I was concerned that this was going to happen unless we acted. And I wanted to act in January and February and March and April. And I'm not saying that everything would have been wonderful, but at least if we'd have been acting earlier in the year, I think we would have dissipated some of this and at least got ahead of it. Whereas now we're reacting to events.
And does Mervyn King owe you an apology?
No, not at all. Not at all.
David Blanchflower speaking to The Guardian's Ed Pilkington. Hear more of that interview at guardian.co.uk/audio. I'm Andy Duckworth. Still to come on Guardian Daily, we reveal Britain's best town.
You know, we've got museums, we've got castle, we've got a river, we've got cinema, we've got theatre.
But first, the housing estates on the edge of Palermo were controlled until his arrest last year by the gangster Salvatore Lopiccolo, known as the Baron. Now, police have discovered a complex of passageways 10 metres underneath the housing estate that was being used by the Sicilian Mafia. In Rome for The Guardian is John Hooper.
What the police found was a veritable labyrinth which had been excavated underneath a block of flats in a poor area in the north of Palermo, what in Britain we would call council flats. This was a big block of flats, and underneath it was, first of all, a refuge for fugitives, it's suspected, and then from there, through a steel door, the police were able to get into this maze of passageways, at the end of which was a firing range.
How was it possible for this complex to remain undetected for so long?
Well, it's in an area which is a true fiefdom of the Mafia. It's an area called the Northern Expansion Zone. It was a classic housing development of the 1960s or 70s, I believe, and it became the fiefdom of the Lopiccolo family, led by a man who goes by the nickname of the Baron. He's been locked up. He was an aspiring boss of all bosses, who was picked up before he could get to the very top of Cosa Nostra. But the men that he left behind have kept an iron grip on that area. And one of the things that the police said is that it's really impossible to get into these flats without being seen by Mafia lookouts, who then alert people who can escape off down passageways like the ones that were found on this occasion. What happened was that they were raiding the house, the flat of a suspected drug trafficker, and one of the policemen noticed a very big bunch of keys, suspiciously big, and said, well, what are all these for? And that's when they started to investigate further.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Finally, two modest market towns in the north of England have been named the best places in Britain to live and work. Richmond and Skipton heftily outscored the likes of Kensington in London and Brighton on the south coast. Character and friendliness tipped the scales, according to judges from the Academy of Urbanism, a think tank drawn from leading architects and town planners. The other winners were Bristol in the cities class, Oxford's restored castle and former prison for a sense of place, and the jewellery quarter of central Birmingham for the best small neighbourhood. We've sent The Guardian's Northern editor, Martin Wainwright, to experience the delights Richmond has to offer.
Richmond is a lovely place. I'm standing in the market square. The castle, the huge Norman castle, is rising up behind me. And just down here is Richmond Market. And given that this is a market town, that's perhaps the place to start.
Well, it's a fine old Georgian town, and we've got lots of things that people can come and look at. We've got the castle, of course. We have a market, an outdoor market on a Saturday, but the indoor market is open every day with various stores, from cakes, plants, handbags and, you know, whatever you might be looking for.
I'm just going to meet the mayor of Richmond, Councillor Judith Steggles, a former English teacher and great enthusiast. When the judges for the best town competition came here in August, she was telling me she was all at sea. She was on HMS Richmond, the frigate, Royal Navy frigate named after this town, which was giving her a demonstration in the Solent of flying its helicopter and doing manoeuvres.
The town was very, very busy during that particular period because we had Circus Skills Week in the Georgian Theatre, so it was buzzing with young people juggling on unicycles and doing all sorts of tricks and things for this Circus Skills Week. And when the actual judges came, the town was buzzing because there was all these young people around and they thought that was wonderful. And as far as I know, because obviously not being here didn't help, but as far as I know, they were quite enchanted by it. The weather was very good and our floral decorations looked good. And I say our castle, obviously, which is just here, you know, is obviously a great attraction to people. And the fact that we've got such ancient buildings around, they just love that.
It's an outstandingly pretty place, nobody doubts that. But
there is a strong sense of community. And I say people are hotly jealous of our traditions and they love the idea that I am the only mayor in England that's allowed to carry my own mace.
Oh. And you're full of enthusiasm. May I ask, what brought you a Richmond? Are you a lass of Richmond Hill yourself, you come here?
Not actually, no. I've been up here for nearly 37 years. For such a small town, you know, we've got museums, we've got castle, we've got a river, we've got cinema, we've got theatre. Our Georgian theatre is a gem.
Wonderful. I know it well, yes. Yes,
absolutely,
that's great.
Absolutely brilliant. I was there at the weekend.
I've just joined the bus queue. There seem to be a lot of buses in Richmond, though I've just been assured that this isn't necessarily so. But I've got a gentleman here. You come up to Richmond, you were telling me...
Yeah, I come up to see my son from London.
Right.
And I actually think Richmond's a nice little town.
How does it compare with London?
London's a dump. I am born and bred London.
Yes.
But I can't wait to move out.
So there you have it, Richmond, the best town in Britain. And when you're sitting here having a coffee in the station, you can see why Richmond, this little place in Yorkshire, beat the likes of Brighton, Stirling and a lot of other much bigger towns to the title.
Martin Wainwright in Richmond, North Yorkshire. That's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 in the morning. Producing today, Ben Green and Tim Mabey. I'm Andy Duckworth. Thanks for listening.